craftsmen coming and going, it's easier to leave things open for the time being. Mr. Ravenel told me they've had to pull up floors to install modern plumbing, and replace entire walls that were rotting from bad drainage. In fact, the entire east wing has been closed until they can restore it at some future date.
It would be better to raise the whole house to the ground and build a new one. Why try to resurrect an oversized old rubbish heap?
Garrett's lips quirked at his description of the elegant and historic estate. Ancestral pride? She suggested.
Ethan snorted. From what I know of the Ravenel ancestors, they have little reason for pride.
Garrett sat on the edge of the mattress with one leg folded beneath her. They're your ancestors too, she pointed out. And it's a renowned family name.
That means nothing to me,
Ethan said irritably.
And I have no right to the Ravenel name, and no desire to claim kinship of any of them.
Garrett strove for a neutral tone, but she couldn't quite keep the concern out of her voice. You have three half-sisters. Surely you'll want to become acquainted with them.
Why would I? What would that get me?
A family. Ethan's eyes narrowed.
You'd like a connection to them, would you? You should have let Lady Helen introduce you to West Ravenel. By now, you'd be a member of the family in full.
Taken aback by how quickly his mood had changed, Garrett replied calmly, Good heavens, how cross you sound. I don't want Mr. Ravenel, I want you. It doesn't matter to me what your name is or what connections you have. If it makes you unhappy to associate with the Ravenels, we won't. Your feelings matter to me more than anything else. Ethan gave her an arrested stare, the chill vanishing rapidly from his eyes, and he reached for her with a quiet groan, pulling her close. Mindful of the bandage beneath his shirt, Garrett protested, Please be careful of your wound. But the muscles in his arms kept tightening until she was forced to lean on his sturdy chest. His fingers wove into her hair, disheveling the loosely pinned locks, and he nuzzled his face against her head. They stayed like that, breathing together. At length, Ethan said,
How could I ever say Angus Ransom wasn't my father? He took my mother to wife and raised me as his own, and never let on to me that I was another man's bastard. A decent man he was, for all that he went on the drink more than he should, and was too fond of giving me the back of his hand. He kept me fed and taught me to work. And more to the back of all that, he saw to it that I learned to read and cipher. There were things I hated about him, but I loved the man.
Then you must honour his memory, Garrett said, touched by his loyalty. Do what you feel is right. Just remember that it's not fair to blame Mr. Ravenel and Lord Tranier for past events they had nothing to do with. They've done nothing but try to help you. Mr. Ravenel went so far as to give you his own blood. She made her voice very soft as she added, That deserves some gratitude, doesn't it?
Aye,
Ethan said gruffly and fell silent, his fingers moving lightly in her hair.
About the transfusion, he said eventually. Does it alter a man? Change his nature in some way, if he's given someone else's blood?
Garrett lifted her head and regarded him with a faint, reassuring smile. That question is still being debated among scientists, but no, I don't believe so. Although blood is a vital fluid, it has nothing to do with a person's characteristics, any more than the heart has to do with one's emotions. Reaching up with her hand, she softly tapped her forefinger against his temple. Everything you are, all you think and feel, is in here.
Ethan looked baffled. What do you mean about the heart?
It's a hollow muscle.
It's more than that.
He sounded vaguely outraged, like a boy who'd just been told there was no Father Christmas. Symbolically, yes, but emotions don't actually come from there.
They do,
Ethan insisted. Taking her hand, he brought it down to his chest and pressed her palm flat against the strong beat.
The love I have for you, I feel it, right here. My heart beats for you all on its own. It aches when we're apart. Nothing tells it to do that.
If Garrett had any defences left, they fell away in that moment like scaffolding from around her heart. Rather than debate physiology or explain the brain's influence on muscular action, she raised herself over to his chest to kiss him tenderly. She had intended the contact to be brief, but Ethan responded passionately, sealing their mouths together. He continued to press her hand against his chest, and she thought of the first night they had arrived in Eversby Priory, when she had stood by his bed and collected his heartbeats in her palm. He consumed her, taking deeper, rougher tastes, sucking and gnawing as if he were pulling sweetness from a honeycomb. It went on for fevered minutes, kisses of soft velvet and slow fire, until she became aware that the big, masculine body beneath hers was primed for an activity he wasn't nearly ready for yet. As she felt the stiff ridge of his arousal through the layers of their clothes, her brain clamoured a warning through the erotic haze. She tried to roll off him, but his hands clamped on her hips to keep her in place. Turning her mouth from his, she gasped, "Let me down! I'll hurt you!"
"You're as late as a petal." Trying a different avenue of escape, Garrett wriggled downward, but the movement sent a deep, hot throb of sensation through her. She stopped, her pelvis frozen against his, all her nerves and muscles tensed at the verge of release. Quivering, all she could think of was how much she wanted to grind against that hard shaft in tight circles. She glanced at Ethan, whose eyes were lit with wicked amusement. Her face flamed as she realized he knew exactly what she was feeling. One of his hands slid over her bottom, cupping firmly. His hips nudged forward, making her gasp.
"Let me help you, Agra," he whispered.
"You can help me by resting, and not reopening your wound from too much exertion."
He nuzzled at her throat and had the audacity to say,
"I still have 118 positions left to show you."
Garrett pushed his hands away and rolled off him carefully. Her hair tumbled from its pins as she sat up. "Not unless you want to expire in the attempt."
"Sit right here," he invited, patting his lap. "We'll do something easy and slow."
"It's not just the physical effort I'm worried about, it's your blood pressure. You had arterial surgery 2 weeks ago, Ethan. You must stay calm and quiet until it heals completely."
"It already has. I'm almost back to normal."
Garrett gave him an exasperated glance as she tried to twist up her hair and pin it. "Unless you found a way to defy the laws of biological science, you most certainly have not healed completely."
"I failed enough for this."
"As your doctor, I disagree."
"I'll prove it to you."
Watching for her reaction, he slid his hand downward to the bulging front of his trousers and began to rub slowly. Garrett's eyes widened.
"You're not really going to..."
"Good God, stop that this instant!" She grabbed his wrist, tucking his hand away from his groin. To her annoyance, he was chuckling richly. Flustered and annoyed, she muttered,
"Oh, go on then and stimulate yourself into an aneurysm."
Ethan grinned.
"Stay and watch," he said, shocking her further.
Hooking an arm around her waist, he took her down with him and grunted in discomfort as they both fell heavily to their sides.
"Damn it!"
"It serves you right," Garrett exclaimed, while he continued to chuckle.
"Come on now, don't scold," he coaxed,
nestling her back into him.
"Stay here and lie with me."
His smiling lips played tenderly behind her ear and along her neck.
"Stay in my arms where you belong, Cushla McCree."
He ran his hands over her body, fondling lightly here and there.
"I've a matter to take up with you, by the way."
He rubbed his lips against the edge of her ear.
"You haven't kept your promise."
Perplexed, Garrett turned her face in his direction.
"What promise?"
His mouth brushed her cheek as he spoke.
"The night of the surgery. The last thing I asked was for a few words from you. But you wouldn't say them."
"Oh."
Colour rushed beneath the tender pressure of his lips.
"I was afraid to," she confessed, huskily. "I thought you might live longer if I made you wait."
"I'm still waiting."
"I didn't mean to. I'm sorry I've been so... But I do.
Of course I do."
Carefully, Garrett turned within the warm haven of his arms and lay facing him. She cleared her throat before saying, in a slightly clenched voice,
"I love you."
At the very same moment, Ethan had begun to ask,
"Do you mean you..."
They both fell silent, how thoroughly awkward. With a defeated groan, Garrett turned onto her back and closed her eyes, too embarrassed to look at him. The first time she'd ever said it to a man, and she made a hash of it. "I love you," she repeated. But it didn't sound at all the same as when he'd said it. She wanted to add something to make it more eloquent, but she couldn't think of what.
You had such a lovely way of putting it, she grumbled, even when you were half conscious. I wish I could say something poetic, because I feel... But you were right, I don't have a romantic bone in my body.
Sweet love, look at me.
She opened her eyes to find Ethan staring down at her in a way that made her feel sun-dazzled.
You don't have to be poetic, he said. You've held my life in your hands. When I was near death, you were the anchor to my soul.
His fingertips slid from her temple and down over her flushed cheek, stroking tenderly.
I never dared to dream of hearing those three words from you.
They're beautiful when you say them. Garrett smiled reluctantly. I love you, she said again. And this time it felt easier and more natural. His lips strayed over the tip of her nose, her cheeks, her chin, before wandering back for another dizzying kiss.
Let me pleasure you. After all the care you've taken of me, let me do at least that much for you.
The idea quivered through her, but she shook her head and said, I didn't go to the trouble of saving your life, merely for you to toss it away in a moment of self-indulgence.
I only want to play,
Ethan coaxed, and loosening the fastenings of her bodice. It's a dangerous game.
What's this?
His fingers curled around a long pink silk cord and tugged, gently unearthing a small object from beneath her chemise. It was the little silver whistle he'd given her. Closing his hand around the bright metal, still warm from her skin, he sent her a questioning look. Turning pink, Garrett confessed sheepishly, It's a sort of talisman. Whenever you're not with me, I pretend I can use it to send for you and you'll magically appear.
Whenever you want me, love, I'll always come running.
You didn't the last time I tried it. When I finished my rounds at the workhouse, I stood on the front steps and blew this whistle with no results whatsoever.
I was there.
Ethan stroked the hollow of her throat with the rounded end of the whistle.
You just couldn't see me.
Truly? He nodded, setting aside the gleaming little tube.
You were wearing the dark green dress with a black trim. Your shoulders were drooping, and I knew you were tired. I thought of all the women in London who were safe and cozy in their homes, while you were standing out in the dark, after spending your evening taking care of people who couldn't afford a penny for your services. You're the best woman I've ever known, and the most beautiful.
He tugged her chemise down, and drew the spread fingertips of one hand over her exposed chest, the side of his smallest finger brushing a tender pink bud, as if by accident. Her throat closed on a whimper. Using his fingertips, he rolled and stroked the sensitive peak, then moved to her other breast, gently clamping the nipple between his thumb and forefinger. It's too soon for this, Garrett said anxiously, and managed to turn onto her side, facing away from him. Ethan reached out and tucked her back into the exciting weight and hardness of his body. She felt the curve of his smile at the nape of her neck, as if her perfectly rational concerns were unwarranted.
Akushla, you've had your say for the past 2 weeks, and I've abided by your rules.
You fought my rules every step of the way, she protested.
I've been drinking that evil tonic you've been giving me, he pointed out.
You've been pouring it into a potted fern whenever you think I'm not looking.
It tastes worse than the Thames, he said flatly. The fern thought so too, which is why it turned brown and died.
A laugh bubbled up before she could stop it, but her breath caught as one of his muscular legs came between hers and urged her thighs apart. His hands slid under her skirts and into the open seam of her drawers, until he found the bare skin above the top of her stocking garter. The massaging stroke of his thumb, high inside her thigh, made her weak with excitement.
You want me?
Ethan said with satisfaction as he felt her tremble. You're impossible, she moaned. You're the worst patient I've ever had. His husky laugh tickled her neck.
No,
he whispered,
and the best. Let me show you how good I am.
Breathing raggedly, Garrett started to wriggle away from him, then checked the movement.
That made him laugh again. That's right, don't struggle. You might hurt me.
Ethan, she said, trying to sound stern. This is too much exertion for you.
I'll pull away if I feel myself starting up in a passion.
He untied her garters and pulled down her drawers, murmuring in her ear all the while, telling her how sweet she was to the touch, how he longed to kiss and love every part of her. His hand slid between her parted thighs, stroking the folds of her sex open, teasing and teasing until her skin was sweat-misted and hot, and all her muscles were clenching. Gently his fingertip found the entrance to her body and wriggled into silkiness, wetness, pulsing warmth. They both groaned softly. Garrett tried desperately not to move, as his finger eased farther into the wet, grasping depths, pushing in deep, sliding out slowly and back in again. "Eaton," he begged. "Let's wait until you've healed properly, please, please. 7 more days, that's all." A breath of laughter rushed across her bare shoulder as he worked at the front of his trousers. "Not 7 more seconds." Garrett squirmed as she felt the pressure of a smooth, broad shape at the tender breach of her sex. She couldn't hold back a moan. The rim of her entrance contracted, tiny muscles grasping for the blunt, silken pressure.
"You're trying to pull me in," came his dark whisper. "I can feel it. Your body knows where I belong."
She felt a liquid nudge, her flesh tightening, then yielding at the helpless sensation of being opened and penetrated. He entered an inch or two. Agitation quickened her blood as she lay there cradled and surrounded with that hot, teasing presence just inside her. Garrett had no idea how many minutes passed while they lay together, motionless, except for the rhythms of their breathing. Her body stretched, a slight relaxation, and there was another slight easing inward. In the dreamlike stillness, she began to feel fuller and fuller. He was gradually moving deeper, occupying her in such slow increments that she couldn't perceive whether the impetus was coming from him or herself. Some of it had to be her own doing. The maddening craving had made it impossible to stay absolutely still. Her hips kept spasming with the urge to push down on that tantalizing hardness. Every sensation was magnified in the silence. She was acutely aware of the air against her bare legs, the coolness of the linen sheets and knitted cotton bedding beneath her, the hairiness of Ethan's arms across her, the resinous spice of shaving soap, the faint, salty traces of intimacy. Her eyes closed, as she felt the throb of his shaft far up inside her. He was buried to the hilt now, filling her so thickly that she could feel every twitch and pulse of him. They were both outwardly still, while deep inside her flesh was shaping around him, eagerly caressing his hard length, enticing him to stay. She clamped against the swollen invasion, and pleasure washed down to her toes and up to the top of her skull, and the stiff length inside her throbbed and jerked in response, and that made her inner muscles clench again, over and over, the joined flesh squeezing, swelling, throbbing, the deep and secret movements as uncontrollable as her heartbeat. Exquisite heat suffused her until she couldn't stand it any longer. His name broke from her lips in a dry sob. "Eaton!" His hand slid down over her front to the place where she clasped him, and he massaged her sex tenderly, steadily. She arched, her hips locking tight to his, and she convulsed and shuddered within his cradling embrace, the release surging out of control, draining her until she collapsed in his arms like a handful of wilted meadow flowers. Ethan felt her tremble as she realized he was still erect. He ran a soothing hand over her hip and thigh, wishing she were fully naked. She was exquisite, so slim and finely made, her flesh tender and yet filled with tensile strength. They reclined together amid swathes of yellow silk, with her legs and chest bared. He loved the colours of her, pink and mauve and ivory, all washed in light. The glistening tumble of her hair held the colours of autumn, chestnut, maple, russet, umber. He could see her toes curling and relaxing, clean pink little toes, the nails gleaming and filed. Her flesh was snug and lively in the aftermath of her climax, gripping repeatedly to keep hold of him. It was bliss to be inside the hollows and heat and vibrant life of her. She would bend to no man's will, not even his, but she would yield to him out of trust and desire. Only him. Carefully he pulled up her top leg and hooked it back over his, spreading her wider. She made a feeble protest, something about overexerting himself, and he hushed her and kissed behind the ear.
"Trust me," he whispered. "I'll thrive none the worse for loving you, I promise. Now let me have a little more of you."
Now that she was relaxed and accustomed to him, he was able to slide farther inside. She gasped in surprise and caught at his wrist. Concerned that he might be hurting her, he withdrew slightly, but her hips promptly followed the movement, taking him deep again. A grin crossed his lips.
"Hot little wench," he said near her ear. "You'll have your fill of me if that's what you want."
Closing his hand on her hip, he began to move her languidly on his hard, wet shaft, controlling the rhythm, keeping it slow and steady. Her breathing hastened and she melted against him, letting him guide her easily. Every awareness converged as he went deeper and deeper into the mysterious, soft depths of her. And there was no world but her. No breath, no language, no sun, no stars, nothing that didn't begin and end with her. He felt her pleasure take flight again, the slender body arched and taut in the steep ascent, the unfolding rapture. He was with her, inside her, caressing her with every part of himself. The culmination, as it approached, was severe and blinding, searing through him with unimaginable force. He withdrew and slid his shaft against the sweet groove of her firm, pale buttocks and let himself be immolated in the scorching white fire, feeling purified by it, lust and love and pleasure mingling until there was nothing but ecstasy within and without. He felt her quiver at the hot spill of his release against the small of her back. Gently he rolled her to her stomach and used her discarded drawers to wipe away the residue. Gathering her back in his arms, he let out a long, shivering sigh of contentment, a chuckle stirring in his chest. He moved to catch the lobe of her ear with his teeth and touched it with his tongue.
"If that didn't kill me," he couldn't resist murmuring, "nothing will."
Chapter 21. The next day, after Garrett left for her afternoon walk, Ethan ventured downstairs to the first floor by himself. He knew what she would have said about his excursion, and she would have been right, but it was necessary. He was a sitting duck at Eversby Priory, and by extension so were Garrett, West Ravenel, and every other member of the household. He damned well couldn't make an accurate assessment of the situation from his bedroom. From his visits to the upstairs terrace, and a few brief meanderings around the second floor, Ethan had a good sense of his limitations. Overall, he was still weak and prone to tiring easily. He hadn't yet recovered his strength, balance, or mobility. For a man accustomed to functioning at the highest level of physical fitness, it was infuriating to have trouble walking down a flight of stairs. The bullet wound and the surrounding tissue still ached, and there were stabs and zings of pain when he moved his arm or shoulder in certain ways. Garrett had decided it was better not to immobilize the limb, to keep it from weakening and turning stiff. Ethan gripped the balustrade to keep himself steady as he made his painstaking way down the grand staircase. When he was at the halfway point, a footman passing through the entrance hall below caught sight of him and stopped abruptly.
"Sir?"
The footman, a young, big-shouldered fellow with the soft brown eyes of a puppy dog, stared up at him with unease.
"Is there... Do you... May I help?"
"No," Ethan replied pleasantly. "I'm stretching my legs a bit, that's all."
"Yes, sir, but the stairs..."
The footman began to ascend the staircase hesitantly, as if fearing Ethan would topple right in front of him. Ethan didn't know how much the servants had been told about who he was, or about the specifics of his condition, but clearly this footman knew he shouldn't be going anywhere on his own, which was irritating. It also reminded him of how precarious his situation was. All it would take was a whispered confidence between one of these servants and someone in the nearby village, or a casual comment from a delivery man or workman to start rumours spreading.
All servants talk,
Jenkin had once told him.
They notice every deviation from the household's normal pattern, and they draw conclusions. They know what secrets the master and his wife are keeping from each other. They know where the valuables are, how money has been spent, and who's fucking whom. Never believe a servant who claims not to know something. They know everything.
If I may, Mr. Smith, the footman said, continuing up toward him, I'll accompany you the rest of the way.
Mr. Smith?
That was the alias they had come up with?
Holy hell, Ethan said under his breath.
Out loud, he murmured.
No, there's no need.
Perceiving there was no way the footman was going to leave him alone, he added dryly,
But suit yourself.
The footman came to his step and descended at the same pace, ready to spring into action should Ethan require assistance, as if he were a small child or old man.
What's your name? Ethan asked.
Peter, sir.
Peter, what's the below stairs talk about my presence at the estate?
The footman hesitated.
We were told that you were a friend of Mr. Ravenel's, and you were involved in a shooting accident. We had to keep it private, as we do all our guests' business.
And that's all? No rumours or speculation?
Another longer hesitation. There are rumours, Peter said quietly.
Tell me what's being said.
They reached the bottom of the stairs.
Aye. The footman dropped his gaze and fidgeted uncomfortably. I shouldn't, sir. But if I may show you something.
Intrigued, Ethan went with him down a long hallway that opened into a narrow rectangular gallery. The walls were covered from floor to ceiling with framed paintings. The footman led him slowly past a row of portraits, all of Ravenel ancestors in the dress of their time. Some of them were as large as life, in heavy gold frames up to 7 feet high. They stopped in front of a stunning full-length painting of a dark-haired, blue-eyed man in a commanding posture. Strikingly, he was dressed in a full-length blue brocade robe with a gold rope belt. Power and arrogance radiated from the canvas. There was a disconcerting hint of sensuality in the long-fingered hand braced on a lean hip, and in the coolly appraising, secretive stare. And there was something cruel about the mouth. Riveted and repelled, Ethan instinctively backed away from the portrait. He saw the likeness to himself, and his soul revolted. Managing to drag his gaze away, he focused on the worn Persian rug.
That's Master Edmund, he heard the footman say.
I came to Eversby Priory after his lordship had passed on, so I never met him. But some of the older servants saw you when you were brought in, and
they knew. They knew exactly who you were. They were very moved, sir, and said we must all do our best for you. Because you're the last living man in the true bloodline, you see.
At Ethan's silence, the footman continued helpfully. Your blood goes all the way back to Brannock Ravenel, who was one of Charlemagne's 12 paladins. He was a great warrior, the first Ravenel, even if he was French.
Ethan's mouth twitched, despite his inner turmoil. Thank you, Peter. I'd like to be alone for a few minutes.
Yes, sir.
After the footman had left, Ethan went to set his back against the opposite wall. He levelled a brooding stare at the portrait, his thoughts in a welter. Why had Edmund chosen to be portrayed for posterity in such unconventional attire? It seemed like a gesture of disdain, as if he couldn't be bothered to dress for his own portrait. The robe was thickly embroidered and luxurious, something a Renaissance prince might have worn. It conveyed the rather spectacular self-assurance of a man who didn't doubt his own superiority, no matter what he wore. Memories jolted loose as Ethan stared at the resplendent figure in the portrait.
Ah, ma'am, he whispered unsteadily. You shouldn't have had a damn thing to do with him.
How could his mother have thought any good would come of it? She must have been awestruck, intoxicated by the idea of being desired by a man of high position. And some corner of her heart had always been kept for him, this man who had treated her like an object to be used and discarded. Ethan closed his eyes. They turned hot and liquid beneath his lids. A casual masculine voice broke the silence.
Up and about, I see. I'm glad they managed to find clothes to fit you.
Ethan froze,
horrified to be caught in a vulnerable moment by West Ravenel. He darted a blurred glance at him and forced his mind to focus on the conversation. Something about clothes. West's butler and valet had brought an assortment of garments in various sizes from his closet and trunks for him to make use of. Some of the clothes had been costly, with perfect tailoring, and buttons made of gold or ornamental stones such as agate or jasper. But they had been too roomy for Ethan to wear.
"Aye, they did," Ethan muttered.
"Thank you." Swiftly, he dragged a coat sleeve across his eyes and found himself saying the first thing that came to mind.
"You used to be fat."
West seemed amused rather than offended.
"I prefer pleasingly plump. I was a London rake, and for your information, all true rakes are fat. We spend all our time indoors, drinking and eating. Our only exercise consists of bedding a willing wench. Or two."
He gave a nostalgic sigh.
"God, there are times when I miss those days.
Fortunately, I can take a train to London when the need arises."
"There are no women in Hampshire?"
Ethan asked.
West gave him a speaking glance. "You're suggesting I bed the innocent daughter of a local squire, or a wholesome milkmaid? I need a woman with skills, Ransom."
He wandered to a space next to Ethan and braced his back on the wall in an identical posture. As his gaze followed Ethan's to the towering portrait, he looked sardonic. "That painting captures him perfectly. A member of the upper crust, lording it over the crustless."
"Did you know him well?"
"No. I saw the Earl only a handful of times at large family events. Weddings and funerals and such. We were the poor relations, and our presence didn't exactly improve a gathering. My father was a violent sod, and my mother was a coquette who, as they say, had a tile loose. As for my brother and I, we were a pair of sullen tots who went around trying to pick fights with our cousins. The Earl couldn't stand either of us. He caught me by the ear on one occasion and told me I was a bad, wicked lad, and some day he would see to it that I was placed as a cabin boy on a trading vessel bound for China, which would undoubtedly be captured by pirates."
"What did you say?"
"I told him I'd hoped he would do it as soon as possible, because pirates would do a much better job of raising me than my parents." Ethan felt a grin cross his face, when he could have sworn nothing could have made him smile, standing in front of that blasted portrait. "My father thrashed me within an inch of my life afterward," West said. "But it was worth it." He paused reflectively. "That was the last memory I have of him. He died not long after that, brawling over a woman. Dear old Papa was never one to let rational conversation get in the way of his fists." It hadn't occurred to Ethan that West and Devon Ravenel had led anything other than a sheltered and pampered existence. The revelation gave him an unexpected feeling of empathy and kinship. He couldn't help liking West, who was irreverent as hell, at ease with himself and the world, while still retaining the subtle flintiness of a man with few illusions. This was someone he could understand and talk to.
"Did you ever meet the Earl?" West asked, wandering slowly along the row of portraits.
"Once." Ethan had never told a living soul about it. But in the quiet, out-of-time atmosphere of the portrait gallery, he found himself sharing the memory that had haunted him for years.
"When my mother was younger, the Earl kept her for a time. She was a shop girl when they met, and a beauty. She lived in a set of rooms he paid for. The arrangement lasted until she found out she was with child. The Earl didn't want her after that, so he gave her some money and a reference for a job that fell through. Her family had cast her off, and she had nowhere to turn. She knew if she gave her baby to the orphanage, she could take a factory job, but she decided to keep me instead. Angus Ransom, who was the prison guard at Clerkenwell, offered to marry her and raise me as his own. But times grew hard," Ethan continued. "There came a day we couldn't pay the butcher's bill and had no fuel for the hearth. Mam took it upon herself to go to the Earl for help. She thought it wasn't too much to ask of him to spare a few coins for his own child. But it wasn't the Earl's way to give something for nothing. Mam had kept her looks, and he still fancied her for a tumble. After that, she would slip off to meet him when we needed money for food or coal." "Shame on him," West said softly.
"I was still a young boy," Ethan said, "when Mam took me for an outing one day in a hansom cab. She said we were going to visit a gentleman friend of hers who wanted to meet me. We went to a house like nothing I'd ever imagined. Fine and quiet, with polished floors and gold columns on the sides of the doorways. The Earl came downstairs wearing a velvet dressing robe similar to that one. Ethan gave a brief nod in the direction of the painting. After asking me a few questions, did I go to school, which Bible story was my favourite, he patted me on the head and said I seemed a bright boy, for all that I had the accent of an Irish tinker. He pulled a little sack of sweets from the pocket of his robe and gave them to me. Barley sugar sticks they were. Mam bade me sit in the parlour while she went upstairs to talk with the Earl. I don't know how long I waited there eating barley sweets. When Mam came down, she appeared the same as when we'd arrived, not a hair out of place. But there was something humbled in the look of her. I was old enough to understand they'd done something wrong, that he'd done something to her. I left a little bag of sweets beneath the chair, but it took weeks for the taste of barley sugar to fade from my mouth. On the way home, Mam told me the man was very important, a high-born gentleman, and he was my real father, not Angus Ransom. I could tell she took pride in it. In her mind, I'd gained something. Now that I knew I was the son of a great man, an aristocrat, she didn't understand. I just lost the only father I'd ever known. I could hardly look at Angus for months afterwards. Now I knew I wasn't his. Till the day he died, I always wondered how many times he glanced at me and saw another man's bastard. Ravenel was silent for a while, looking angry and resigned. "I'm sorry," he eventually said. "'Twas none of your doing. I'm still sorry. For centuries, the Ravenels have turned out one generation of cruel, irresponsible asses after another. West shoved his hands in his pockets and glanced over the rows of stern, haughty faces from the past. "Yes, I'm referring to you," he said to the crowd of portraits. "The sins of your fathers rained down on you like poison, and you passed it down to your children, and then they did the same. There wasn't a decent man in the lot of you." He turned to Ethan. "Soon after Devon's son was born, he came to me and said, 'Someone has to absorb all the poison that's been passed down through generations and keep it away from the ones who come after us. It has to stop with me. God help me, I'm going to protect my child from my own worst instincts. I'm going to block every violent, selfish impulse that was instilled in me. It won't be easy, but I'll be damned if I turn out a son who's exactly like the father I hated.'" Ethan stared at him, struck by the wisdom and resolve in those words. He realised these distant Ravenel cousins were far more than a pair of carefree toffs who've had the luck to come into an unexpected inheritance. They were trying like hell to save an estate, and even more, to save a family. For that, they had his respect. "Your brother may be the first Earl who's ever been worthy of the title," Ethan said.
"He didn't start out that way,"
West replied and laughed. When the brief flare of amusement faded, he said, "I understand why you want nothing to do with the Ravenels. Edmund was an unfeeling monster, and on top of that, no one likes to admit they're the product of 6 centuries of inbreeding. But everyone needs someone to turn to, and we are your family. You should get to know us. If it helps, I'm the worst of the lot. The rest are all much better than me." Ethan approached him and extended a hand.
"You'll do well enough for me," he said gruffly.
West grinned at him. When they shook hands, it felt like a promise had been made, a commitment.
"No," Ethan said. "Where'd you keep the guns?"
Ravenel's brows shot upward.
"Ransom, if you don't mind, I prefer easing into a new topic with a transitional phrase or two." "Usually I do," Ethan said, "but I tire easily, and this is my nap time."
"May I ask why we're arming ourselves instead of napping?"
"Because we were nearly murdered 2 weeks ago, and we're fairly certain someone will come to finish the job."
West turned serious, his gaze sharpening. "If I'd been through what you have, Ransom, the devil knows I'd be jumpy too. But no one's going to come here looking for you. Everyone thinks you're dead."
"Not without a body," Ethan said. "Unless they find one, they'll never stop looking for me."
"Why would they even suspect you're here? They won't connect you to the Ravenels. The river police who brought you to Ravenel House were too terrified to say a word to anyone."
"At the time, they probably were. But either of them could have mentioned it to a friend or sweetheart or
bend the elbow a time too many at the local tavern and say something to the barkeep. Eventually, they'll be taken in for questioning, because they were on patrol that night. They won't hold out for long under interrogation. Furthermore, any of the servants at Ravenhill House may let something slip. A housemaid could say something to the fruit seller at the market. West looks sceptical. Do you really think a few careless words in a tavern, or a bit of gossip from a housemaid to a market seller, would make its way to Jenkins's ears? The question was reasonable, but it almost stunned Ethan. He'd realised he'd lived far too damn long in Jenkins's complex and secretive world. He'd forgotten that most people had no idea what was really taking place around them.
Long before Jenkins recruited me, Ethan said, he started constructing a network of informants and spies all over the United Kingdom. Ordinary people in ordinary towns. Coachmen, innkeepers, sellers, prostitutes, domestic servants, factory workers, university students, all part of an intelligence-gathering apparatus. They're paid stipends with secret grant money Jenkins receives from the Home Office. The Prime Minister knows about it, but says he prefers to remain unaware of the details. Jenkins has made a science of gathering and analysing information. He has at least 8 active officers who've been specially trained to carry out any task he assigns. They're outside the law. They have no fear, they have no scruples, they have little to no regard for human life, including their own.
And you're one of them, West said quietly.
I was. Now I'm a target. By now, someone in the village knows that a pair of strangers have been staying at Eversby Priory. My servants wouldn't say a word to anyone. You have carpenters, painters, and workmen coming and going. They have eyes and ears.
Very well. Let's assume you're right, and Jenkins will send someone after you. I can close this house as tight as a tuppence.
There's not one lock in this entire house they couldn't pick in less than a minute, including the front door. And your servants don't seem to bother with locks in the first place.
They will if I tell them to.
That would be a start. Ethan paused. I'll have recovered enough to leave for London in a week, but until then, I'll have to take security measures in case Jenkins' men find me here.
I'll show you to the gun closet.
There's a gun room in the floor plans, on this level of the house. We turned that into an office room with a connecting lavatory. Now we keep the firearms in a gun closet off the servants' hall under charge of the butler.
Ethan gave him a narrow-eyed glance.
West looked irritable. Does it look like we can afford to host long, expensive shooting parties? We've sold off the hounds. Our gamekeeper is a fossil. We let him have a few birds only to give him something to do. The animals on this estate are used for food, work, and profit, not entertainment. And before I take you below stairs to see the gun closet, you should be prepared for the fact that most of the guns are old and rusted. Hardly anyone here except me even knows how to use one.
Are you a good shot?
Middling. I'm an excellent shot if the targets hold still, but they so rarely do.
As Ethan considered the situation, he fought against a wave of exhaustion.
Forget about the gun closet, then. We'll do what we can to shore up our defences. Tell the servants to start locking the damn doors at night, including their own doors when they're asleep. And we'll need bolts installed in every attic and basement opening, cellar and jib door, luggage hoist, coal lift, every means of internal communication. Also, pull down the scaffolding and platforms on the south side of the house.
What? No, I can't do that.
The scaffolding provides outside access to any window or balcony on that entire facade.
Yes, Ransom, that's the point. I have stonemasons restoring ornamental openwork.
Faced with Ethan's unyielding expression, West groaned.
Do you know how many days the stonemasons took to build that scaffolding? Do you have any idea of what they're going to do to me if I tell them to pull it all down and put it back up a week later?
You won't have to worry about assassins from London. My workmen will happily string us both up in short order.
A terrible weariness had begun to invade Ethan's muscles, and he felt a pressing need for sleep.
Damn it.
I'd spare you all of this by leaving now, if I were able, he muttered, passing a hand over his forehead.
No, West said instantly, his tone changing. Pay no attention to my complaining. God knows no one else does. You belong here.
He ran an evaluating glance over Ethan.
You look ready to drop. I'll accompany you upstairs.
I don't need help.
If you think I'm going to risk having anything happen to you, and then face Dr. Gibson's wrath, you're mad. I'd rather take on a baker's dozen of assassins.
Ethan nodded and headed out of the gallery.
They won't send more than 3 men, he said. They'll come in the wee hours of the morning, while it's still dark and the household is sleeping soundly.
Eversby Priory has over 200 rooms. They won't know the layout.
Yes, they will. The floor plans and specifications can be retrieved from the offices of any architect, contractor, or surveyor who's had anything to do with the rebuilding of this place.
West heaved a sigh, conceding the point.
Don't forget my London banker, he said glumly. He asked for copies when we were arranging for loans.
Apologetically, Ethan said,
They won't want to cause unnecessary casualties. All they'll want is to find me. I'll surrender myself before I let anyone here get hurt.
Damned if you will, West retorted. The Ravenel family motto is, Loyalty binds us. I'll blow the head off of any bastard who threatens one of my kinsmen.
Chapter 22
Is this how they did it at Miss Primrose's?
Ethan asked, standing back as a pair of footmen, supervised by the elderly butler, Sims, ceremoniously laid tablecloths on the ground beneath a shade tree. They proceeded to set out china plates, silver flatware, and crystal goblets. Garrett shook her head, watching with a bemused smile as ice buckets filled with bottles of lemonade, ginger beer, and claret were arranged beside the dishes. Our picnics were bread, jam, and a slice of cheese, carried in a tin pail. It had been her idea to have lunch with Ethan on the estate grounds, within the shelter of a high garden wall. She had told Ethan about the picnics she and her classmates used to enjoy at school, and he said he'd never been on one. Garrett had asked the housekeeper if she could borrow a basket to carry out some items from the daily sideboard buffet. Instead, the cook had provided what she had called a proper picnic, in a pair of massive wicker and leather hampers. After Sims and the footman had departed, Ethan sat with his back against the tree trunk and watched as Garrett unearthed a feast from the hampers. There were boiled eggs, plump olives, stalks of crisp green celery, jars of pickled carrots and cucumbers, sandwiches wrapped in paraffin paper, cold fried oyster patties and wafer crackers, jars of finely chopped salads, a weighty round of white cheese, muslin-lined baskets filled with finger cakes and pastry biscuits, a steamed cabinet pudding left in its fluted stoneware mould, and a wide-mouthed glass bottle filled with stewed fruit. As they ate a leisurely meal beneath the dense green beech canopy, Garrett was pleased to see Ethan relaxing. For the past 5 days, he had been more active than she would have preferred, going through every nook and cranny of Eversby Priory with West. As with most ancient manor houses, many modifications and additions had been made over the centuries, resulting in quirks, oddly shaped spaces, and offset stairs and windows. Despite Garrett's concerns that he would set back his recovery, Ethan had painstakingly made his way to each level of the house to assess it with his own eyes. New bolts and locks had been installed, and the outside scaffolding had been removed. Doors were now routinely locked every night, and so were the ground and basement windows. The household staff had been instructed to raise an alarm if they heard suspicious noises at night, but under no circumstances should they confront a housebreaker on their own. Although Ethan had continued to heal and improve at an impressive rate, it would take weeks or even months for him to reach the level of health he'd enjoyed before his injury. It exasperated him to be constrained by his physical limitations, having been accustomed to inexhaustible reserves of energy and strength. It had been almost 3 weeks since Ethan had been shot. In ordinary circumstances, Garrett would have insisted that he wait twice that amount of time before leaving the estate. However, this situation was far from ordinary. Whether or not she approved, Ethan had told her, he had to leave for London the day after tomorrow. He couldn't continue to remain at Eversby Priory and put the household at risk. Nor could he stand by and do nothing, after Jenkin had diverted 8 tons of stolen explosives to a terrorist group that could conceivably blow up the House of Commons. Reaching out to the luxuriant undergrowth of wintergreen shrubs beneath the stand of beeches, Ethan plucked a sharp, minty leaf. He lay back on the cloth and nibbled on the bit of green, staring up at the canopy of sky and leaves overhead. The beeches were gnarled and graceful, their branches tangling as if they were holding hands. All that could be heard were rustling leaves and the trill of a wood warbler. The air was fresh with the loamy scent of rich earth. Rustling leaves and the occasional trill of a wood warbler were the only sounds they could hear.
"I have never been in a place so peaceful outside of a church," Ethan said.
"It's a world away from London." Oh, the clashing fire bells and the roar of railways and construction, and the air filthy with smoke and dust, and all those tall buildings blocking out the sun.
"Aye," Ethan said. "I miss it too."
They both chuckled. "I miss my parents and the clinic," Garrett confessed. "Now that you're too healthy for me to fuss over, I must have something to do."
"You could begin writing a memoir," he suggested.
Unable to resist the temptation he presented, Garrett bent over until their noses nearly touched. "My life," she told him, "hasn't been nearly sensational enough for my memoir to be interesting."
"You're in hiding with a fugitive," he pointed out.
Her lips quirked. "That means you're the one with an interesting life, not me." Ethan traced the edge of her low-necked gown with his fingertips and hooked his forefinger into the soft valley between her breasts.
"We'll return to London soon, and I'll provide all the excitement you want."
His lips brushed hers with teasing dry warmth, and she let him draw her down, increasing the pressure until the kiss was strong and damp and savouring. Her senses were filled with him, the sweet taste of his mouth, the vital feel of his body as he pulled her full length against him. In the past week, Ethan had made love to her twice more, managing to overcome her concerns with a perfect mixture of reassurance and temptation. The man was a silver-tongued devil. He spent long minutes whispering, kissing, caressing her, until every subtle movement sent delight humming through deep, secreted chords in her body. Trying to keep her mind on the conversation, Garrett turned her mouth from his long enough to ask, "What are you planning to do when we return? Go to the Lord Chancellor, the Attorney General?"
"I'm not sure who to trust," Ethan said ruefully. "I think it's best to put them all on the hook by making the information public."
Propping up on her elbow, Garrett looked down into his face with a slight frown. "But you gave the evidence to Commissioner Felbrick. Will we have to break into Lord Tatton's safe again?"
"I kept a few extra pages," he said. "Just in case."
Her eyes widened. "Where did you put them?" A lazy smile curved Ethan's lips. He was a handsome sight, his skin gold-dusted in the light, his eyes dark and vivid blue.
"Can't you guess?"
"Somewhere in your flat?"
"I gave them to you."
"To me? How?" Garrett laughed. "You wrapped them with the monkey picture."
"I pasted an envelope to the back of it," he said. "It contains the pages and a copy of my will."
Although Garrett had been about to ask more about the evidence, she was distracted by that last part. "You have a will?" she asked skeptically. He nodded.
"I named you as the sole beneficiary."
Surprised and touched, Garrett said, "That's very kind of you. But shouldn't you leave your possessions to a relation?"
"My mother was cast off by her family. I'd never give them a farthing. And anyone on the ransom side would put it to ill use. No, it's all for you. When the time comes, hopefully none too soon, you'll be well taken care of. My lawyers will help you through the patent rights transfers, not only here but abroad. Everything will be put in your name and..."
"What in heaven's name are you talking about?" Garrett asked in bewilderment. "Patents for what?"
"For lock designs."
He began to toy with the trimmings on her dress, tracing the seams with his forefinger.
"I have about 3 dozen. Most of them are insignificant and don't turn in a farthing in profit, but a few."
"I call that impressive," Garrett exclaimed, beaming with pride. "How many talents you possess. You're going to be a great success some day, in some profession other than spying, I mean."
"Thank you,"
Ethan said, enjoying her praise.
"But there's more to tell you. You see..."
"Yes. Tell me everything. When did it start?"
"It was while I was still apprenticing for the Clerkenwell locksmith. I'd worked out a way to make the standard cell locks pickproof by adding a stop plate to the bolt. The prison governors and the locksmith had me draw the plans and write out the specifications, and then they took out a patent on the invention. They made a pretty penny on it. With a cynical twist of his mouth, Ethan added, "They cut me out of the profits since I was only a boy." "Scoundrels," Garrett said indignantly.
"Aye," came his rueful agreement. "But the experience put me in the learning of patent applications. And the years after that, whenever I came up with an improvement on an existing lock design or a new prototype, I registered a patent under the name of an anonymous holding company." He paused. "A handful of them still earn royalties."
"How wonderful." Her brain began to calculate possibilities. "If we add those to what I earn, someday we might be able to sell my house in King's Cross and buy a larger one." For some reason, the statement seemed to disconcert Ethan. Garrett's face flamed as she realized the assumption she'd made. "Forgive me," she said hastily. "I didn't mean to imply there's no obligation."
"Hush," Ethan interrupted firmly, and pulled her head down to his.
After quieting her with a long, searching kiss, he drew back and smiled at her.
"You jumped to the wrong conclusion, love. Let me explain."
"You don't have to." His forefinger touched her lips in a brief caress.
"I receive annual income from selling usage rights and privileges to manufacturers. Sometimes I take shares of a company in lieu of cash. I have stock and securities in more businesses than I could name offhand. I run everything through holding companies to remain anonymous. I employ 3 solicitors full-time, just to handle patent infringements. And I have 2 others on general retainer."
Slowly it dawned on Garrett that this so-called hobby of his was far more lucrative than she'd assumed. "But you said your patents were insignificant."
"I said most of them are, but a handful turned out to be not so insignificant. A few years ago, I came up with the idea for a permutation lock."
"What is that?"
"It's an assortment of active and passive tumblers, arranged around a central spindle, all enclosed in a ring that adjusts them."
Ethan paused as he saw her puzzled expression.
"The kind of lock with a dial instead of a key."
"Like the one on the cannonball safe?"
His eyes crinkled slightly at the corners. "Like that one."
Perhaps it was the proximity of his warm body, or the gently wandering hand on her leg and hip, but Garrett's dumbfounded brain was slow to work through the implications of what he'd just revealed. "Was that your design?" she managed to ask. "Is that how you knew how to open it?"
"Aye," Ethan continued slowly, giving her time to digest the information. "Those locks are used by banks, shipping and railway companies, dockyards, warehouses, military outposts, government buildings, everywhere."
Her eyes turned huge.
"Ethan," she began, and paused, unable to think of a civilized way to phrase it.
"Are you rich?" He nodded gravely.
"Regular rich?" she asked. "Or vulgar rich?"
Leaning closer, he whispered near her ear.
"Swiney rich."
Garrett gave a bemused laugh, then shook her head in confusion. "But then why would you work for Sir Jasper? It makes no sense." The question brought a troubled look to Ethan's face.
"At the time the patent royalties started coming in, I'd already been recruited by Jenkin. I didn't want to stop. He was a fatherly figure. His approval, his interest, meant a great deal to me."
"I'm sorry," she said softly, her heart wrenching, as she realized how painful Jenkins' vicious betrayal must have been for him, and perhaps would always be. Ethan gave a short laugh.
"I've never had much luck in the way of fathers."
"Does Sir Jasper know about your patents?"
"I don't think so. I've always been careful to cover my tracks."
"Is that why you lived in an empty flat? To keep anyone from suspecting you had another income?"
"Partly. It's also never mattered what kind of bed I sleep in or what kind of chair I sit on."
"But it does matter."
It concerned and puzzled Garrett that he would deny himself an ordinary life of comfort.
"It should matter." Their gazes met for a long moment.
"It does now," Ethan said in a low voice.
Filled with tenderness and worry, Garrett laid her hand against his lean cheek. "You haven't been kind to yourself. You must deal more gently with yourself." He nuzzled into her palm.
"I have you to be kind to me. I have you to deal with me in any manner you wish."
"I'd like to domesticate you just a little," she said, holding her thumb and forefinger a half inch apart, "but not so much that you would feel like a lapdog. I would